and welcome to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Michaela Kennan here in the KRCB studios with my co-host, Gary Carnevale, our engineer, Mary Moore Campagna. Thank you for tuning in and spending your Sunday evening with us tonight. In a few moments, we'll have a conversation with local author Pamela Fender. She's written a heart-wrenching but very hopeful memoir entitled Beside Myself, Recovery from My Family Betrayal and Estrangement. Later on, we welcome back Rachel Gardner from Food for Thought, Sonoma County's Aid Food Bank. Rachel will tell us all about the upcoming Calabash Festival and everything else that's happening at Food for Thought. And before we get to our guests, here is Greg Moralia with the Outbeat Radio News and Calendar.
I have found Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for this Sunday, September 15th, 2013. Elena Kostyuchenko, a prominent Russian LGBT activist and journalist, is threatening to forcibly out any closeted politician that votes in favor of a proposed bill that would remove children from the households of any and all LGBT or same-sex parents in her homeland. Kostyuchenko, an investigative reporter for the Russian newspaper Novaya Gazeta, announced her initiative via Twitter last week, reportedly asking for information, correspondence, photographs about the deputies of the State Duma concerning LGBT activities. A slightly modified translation of her tweet read, "In the event of the passage of the law to remove children after the first reading, the information about homosexual deputies in the State Duma will be published. Immunity from outing will have only the MPs who voted against the law to remove their children. Others will be disclosed. This is a warning." The bill in question follows international backlash surrounding Russia's current anti-gay propaganda law and the unknown impact the legislation is expected to have on the upcoming 2014 Sochi Olympics. Over the past month, Russia has enabled and perpetuated a culture of fear and violence against LGBT people, seemingly turning a blind eye to both the public acts of violence and private torture on citizens. And here in the U.S., in Hawaii, the Metro Weekly reported that Governor Neil Abercrombie announced Monday that he plans to call a special session of the state legislature starting on October 28th to consider legislation that would pave the way for marriage equality in the Aloha State. Abercrombie said the move stems from his belief that the time has come to put the question of same-sex marriage to rest and is confident that equality will soon come to Hawaii. He said, "This is now the 20th year of discussion that has taken place on the issue and associated issues with it." He added, "I feel very strongly that the votes are there to pass this because it is time for marriage equality to take place." The special session will last 5 days, and the proposed bill will include a religious exemption to quell the fears of those who worry marriage equality will force upon any church. Abercrombie said if the bill is approved, same-sex marriage could begin in the state as early as November 18th. And meanwhile, in Arizona, the Arizona Republic reports an initiative campaign planning to put a ballot measure in favor of marriage equality in Arizona before voters in 2014 has been dropped. Equality Marriage Arizona, the primary group behind the initiative, says efforts were scuttled because key national advocacy groups withheld backing of the initiative for 2014 because they believed there would be a greater chance of winning in 2016. While Simpson expressed frustration about the wait, most advocacy groups agreed that waiting until 2016 would provide the time necessary to rally support for the measure, which would amend the state's constitution to legalize same-sex marriage. Arizona voters amended their constitution to ban same-sex marriage in 2008, approving Proposition 102, which stated, "Only a union of one man and woman shall be valid or recognized as marriage in the state." And here in California, a bill that would help facilitate legal name changes for transgender people was passed by the California State Legislature a week ago Friday. Authored by Assembly Majority Leader Tony Atkins, AB 1121 passed by a vote of 56-18. If signed by Governor Jerry Brown, it will provide an easier and more inexpensive process for Californians seeking to change their name to correspond to their gender identity. The new system will also protect their privacy. And finally, here in the Bay Area, Out and Around, the Rainbow Toastmasters, celebrates its 8th anniversary. Rainbow Toastmasters is celebrating with an exciting multimedia event called Out and Around, which will showcase queer leaders using communication skills at work for LGBT equality around the world. The Out and Around event will feature Lisa Dazzles and Jenny Chang, world travelers in Asia, Africa, and South America searching for super gays, leaders in lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender equality throughout the world. Lisa and Jenny will bring footage from their upcoming documentary, Out and Around, which showcases the exciting people they met and the activities during their travels. There will also be speakers from the Gay Asian Pacific Alliance who will share their personal experiences in some of the same regions. The event will take place at 1800 Market Street in San Francisco on September 26th from 6 to 8 p.m. And to find out more information about local LGBT events happening here in the North Bay, go to gaysonoma.com. And if you have news or an event you'd like to share with our listeners, be sure to tell us about it by going to our own website at outbeatnews.com. And be sure to follow us all week long on Twitter and Facebook for the latest LGBT news and information from here in the North Bay and beyond. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Now back to Outbeat Collage with Michaela Kennan and Gary Carnevale.
Outbeat Radio News, your source for LGBT news from the North Bay and beyond.
And welcome back to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. Thanks, Greg. I'm Michaela Kennan, and I am here in the KRCB studios with my co-host Gary Carnevale. Mary Moore Campagna is on the engineering board. We're happy to welcome our first guest, Pamela Fender. She is the author of a memoir entitled Beside Myself, Recovery from My Family Betrayal and Estrangement. In this book, Pamela explores her family's dysfunction, her attempts at escaping them, and most importantly, her recovery. Pamela, welcome to Outbeat Collage.
Thank you. I appreciate you, and I appreciate being here.
Very, very glad to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
Absolutely. Beside Myself exposes what can lurk behind the facade of an American average family that by all appearances is healthy, loving, and functional. In the case of your family, you were targeted by emotionally detached parents and abusive brothers. Tell us a bit about your childhood and the point at which you first realized your family was dysfunctional.
Well, my childhood basically was, you would call, a Leave It to Beaver type family. I always thought it was pretty normal. My mother's alcoholism and my brother's drug abuse was normal to me. I didn't realize it was normal until I went to counseling. I've had many, many years of counseling. I'm not in counseling currently, but the counseling is what basically brought me into realizing about my dysfunctional family and that it's okay to be angry and feeling all of those feelings that I have, you know, with and the dysfunction of the alcoholism and everything that was swept under the rug, my mm-hmm. father's womanizing and that kind of thing. So, mm-hmm.
Your book jumps around in time, but you do a really nice job of tying the chapters together, effectively capturing both the pivotal times in your life and the folks who played a part in it all, both negatively and positively. Give us a little sense of who these people were, and begin with those who caused you the pain, and then those who provided you with the necessary unconditional love and support.
Okay, well, I would have to start with my mother, who was completely narcissistic, always really looking at her own needs and not thinking about my needs or anybody else's for that matter. It was always about her. And my father and his continual criticism and judgment of me. And then my older brother who molested me as a child, and that was pretty painful. And then my middle brother, whose name is Hank in the book, who has continually harassed me and terrorized me since I was 25 years old. The people who have been unconditionally loving me and supportive are not only my very dear close friends, but my wonderful husband, who I just, I don't know where I would be without him, and my two incredibly fabulous sons, Blake and Evan.
Therapy, support groups, and spiritual leaders played an important role in your recovery. When your life seemed to be a nightmare, full of monsters in the guise of family members, how did you manage to find the courage to tell your truth and find the help you needed to cope?
That's a good question. My therapist encouraged me. I've always wanted to write a book, and I wanted to tell my truth. I wanted to tell my story. And my therapist said that I had all summer to write a book, and I had all of these stories in my head, and I went ahead and I just started writing from very early in the morning, and I didn't stop. I wrote about 8 or 10 hours a day, and that was completely liberating for me. Mm. And that was basically how I just got to where I am now. I also discovered that I was codependent, and my therapist had me read Codependent No More, and I said, I'm not codependent. And she said, just read the book. Mm. And when I read the book, I said, oh man. So I realized that yes, not only was I codependent, but that's what I learned how to become with my family of origin. And recovery with Codependence Anonymous meetings, and through my another organization is Twinless Twin Support Group that I'm very involved with, and my dear friends and my family of choice.
Hmm. And your spirituality?
My spirituality, I am a member of the Congregation Near Shalom, Reconstruction Synagogue in Cotati, and have incredible support there.
Hmm. So you were raised in a religious manner, would you say?
I was raised as a Reformed Jew, and I was had a bat mitzvah with my twin, and we I've always followed the faith.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
and found strength in that faith.
I definitely found strength in my faith. It's brought me so much help, and it just doing a lot of spirituality and praying, and we, you know, as Reconstructionists, God is not a gender, and I really like that. Mm-hmm. So that really was really helpful to me, and just knowing that I have a higher power that is there for me with my spiritual community.
Mm-hmm.
Too. Thanks.
Did you question your spirituality at some point? Especially as you began your own healing process, and must have asked questions like, why me, and how did all this come about, and if God loves me, why did God let this happen, et cetera, et cetera.
I never really questioned my spirituality or my heritage. Mm. Mm. It was never a question. I often would think, you know, why did this happen to me, but I also see a lot of people out there who have been abused and have had dysfunctional families that have had it a lot worse than I did. Mm-hmm. So,
so yeah. If I may ask, give me a rough time. How old were you roughly when you began your healing process? You kind of realized what was going on. Are we talking teenage years? Are we talking early adult? Later?
Much later adult. I would say probably within the last few years.
Wow.
Just the last few years.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
And did you always sense that writing would be cathartic for you? Or did you...
Well, the writing process was cathartic and healing. It was more liberating than anything else. It was purging, getting my story out there, regardless of, you know, selling a million copies or anything. I just wanted to tell my truth and let other people see that I've gone through this and that I'm still standing and I'm here and survived it.
And in the process of it all, you attended Sonoma State University. You earned an English degree. You traveled for 9 months. You've built a business. You've raised 2 loving sons. Give us a sense of where you feel your own strength and perseverance comes from.
That's a question that I still ask myself, because I wonder what it was, if it was one significant event or an individual that brought me the strength that I have. And I think it was what I recently mentioned, was that I think that I really wanted to be the mother that I never had. Mm-hmm. And it was just determination. I've always been a very determined person, and when I want something, I go for it, And I sit down, wrote the book. The writing process was, it only took me 3 months to write the book, but it took me more like 6 to 8 months to do the editing process. So, yeah, so that was, I guess what brought me the strength was my family of choice, my children and my husband and my really good supportive friends.
Mm-hmm. And you tell the story in the book about your first draft of the book. I mean, I don't mean to laugh, but I mean, talk about perseverance. So give us a little bit of that story of sitting down.
My very first day of writing, I wrote 8 hours and I decided to write the most difficult about my twin and his death and what surrounded his death. And it was a very difficult chapter to write, as you can imagine. And I had written everything. And then I instead of clicking save as, I clicked save. And my son came in and asked me a question. And I just sort of just clicked on save. And it disappeared into cyberspace. And I cried for 3 hours. And I decided, people were telling me, oh, just write about something funny or write about something that's easier. I said, nope, I'm getting on the horse. And the next day I got back on and I wrote, and I felt that there's a reason for everything. And I really believe that there was a reason that this happened to me. And I ended up with a lot more dialogue in the book, more pages. And I guess it was just something I just needed to get through again. not easy.
And talking about your brother, Steve, your twin brother, who was gay, he plays a very important role in your life and in the book. Despite everything you endured, all the horrible things you endured, I sense that your most painful experience was losing Steve and the circumstances that surrounded his death. Tell us your and Steve's story.
Well, Steve and I were best friends. Twins have a special connection. And I was his life. My children were his children, and we were really close for most of our life. And when he chose to end his life, that was heartbreaking for me. I wouldn't accept that. And I said, no, that's not going to happen. And I will do anything I can to get you out of this depression. And, I guess when someone is determined, as he was as determined as I was for his whatever, you know, what he wanted to do with his ending of his life, that was extremely painful because I did not want to lose him. I wanted to find a way. And sometimes I think that I don't have any guilt around it. I just have a regret that I didn't maybe kidnap him and take him up north, up here, because he's from Los Angeles, to get him the help that he needed. And I think that if he was up here, we could have helped him.
Mm. And you really went through the process with him, from him coming out to you and then telling you that he was HIV positive, and then telling you that he decided to end his life. Talk about, especially as a twin, as a straight woman, experiencing that probably as very few straight people can, as a twin, a straight twin to a gay brother. Talk a bit about your feelings and how you came to accept him and his HIV status, and then had to accept his decision in a way.
I was always accepting of his being gay. That was not a big deal to me at all. I was intrigued and wanted to know more. And then this was when we were 17 years old, and I knew about a year before he told anyone else in the family. And then when he told me he was HIV, that was probably 20, I have to go back a little bit. He was probably around 34 years old. So it was, you know, he was already, you know, 17 years, and then he when he did tell me he was HIV, I was devastated. I thought that was the death sentence. I thought that was it. And he said he wasn't going to die this way. That wasn't going to take his life. And I trusted him, and I felt that this was it. And he was really, really healthy. He got on a really good regimen of medication, and he had a great T cell count, and, you know, really low viral load. He was doing really healthy. And then he decided after 20 years that he was doing really well. And he decided, because he was doing really well, he thought he would stop taking his medication. Mm. And he was also taking 40 milligrams of Prozac for 10 years, which causes depression and suicidal thoughts. And my husband, Jack, and I did a lot of research to find out what medications he was taking and what was working, what wasn't working. And he, at that point, he was on an emotional roller coaster, and after 20 years, and he decided my entire family of origin, he took everyone and sat them down and told them that he was going to end his life, and everyone was okay with it. Mm-hmm. And he told me over the phone about a week later, because I was out of the country. I returned, and he told me that he wanted to take his life. And that was the reading that I did at the author's launch. And it was extremely painful, because I was the only one who was not accepting of it. And he knew that. And I said, well, I'm not okay with that. Hmm. And it was 4 months later, about 4 or 5 months later, when he decided that it was he was going to end his life. Hmm. He attempted once with overdosing on 70 antidepressants. He vomited those up, called out for my mother, who interestingly didn't hear him, which I'm saying that sarcastically. When he did end up in a 72-hour hold, he came back from that, and he decided to stop eating. Mm. And that's when he was living with my mother at the time, and he asked his best friends and me to help him end his life. And we all said, no, because you're not terminally ill. You are depressed. And he knew that the only person that would help him would be my narcissistic mother and my sociopathic brother. Mm. And those are the ones who, you know, they administered him morphine for 10 days while he starved himself, and took 10 days for him to die.
Sorry for your loss.
It's hard.
When you and Gary first met, this was part of you're part of the Redwood Writers group, and I imagine that has provided you some sense of support. But it goes back to this whole, you know, creative process and your writing process, and what that has done to help you at least come to terms with all of your life up until this point. Give us a sense of of what your creative process was like as you were writing the words down and actually giving them shape and sentences, and they were becoming real. They weren't just inside you anymore. They were on paper.
Well, that's a great question, because as I went through my first edit, I was reading the words and not remembering about writing them. I don't remember writing the words. And sometimes I would say, wow, to myself, I don't remember if I wrote this particular topic. And I'd go back and I'd search, and there it was. So there was a lot of it I don't even remember writing, because I've told the story so many times. My stories I've told so many times. Redwood Writers. I wrote it in chapters of each individual person in my family. So it was just a collaboration of just all of this stories from each family member. And then what happened was, a friend of mine, my neighbor friend of mine, asked me if I was a member of the Redwood Writers. And I said, what's that? And she said, what? You're a writer? You don't even know about it? So, of course, knowing me, you know, the way, the person that I am, I went and did some research and found out when their meeting was. And that was in October 2011. And my first meeting, and I went there and I met who was now our future, who was going to be our future president, who is currently the president of our Redwood Writers, which is, happens to be the largest branch of the California Writers Club. We have over 275 members. And I met my editor, Robbie Summers Bryant, and she, I there was something about her that I just loved, and I'm not sure what it was, but I hired her as my editor. And she worked very hard, did an incredible job editing, and we went through at least 15 drafts. Mm-hmm. And she's now the, she's not only just, she was not just my editor, she became a very, very close friend of mine. Mm. So, yes.
I couldn't, it's hard to imagine reliving such painful experiences and getting them down on paper in sort of a I don't want to say rational isn't quite the word, but just a clear cut manner that really anyone can sort of understand and sympathize with. And, you know, it's not the sort of the dysfunction is epic. I mean, you can see that in a film, you can read that in fiction, but when you know it's a memoir, it takes on additional meaning, additional poignancy. Were these things you've been sort of processing through therapy for years, or would you have memories that you had really locked away? That came out through your writing?
I would say the second thing that you said.
The latter.
Latter.
Okay.
It was memories that were locked away, but stories I had told so often. And then when I would write one piece, it would trigger another memory of something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I always encourage people who want to write to just write how you feel and write like you're telling somebody, even though some writers don't agree that you shouldn't write like you're talking to somebody. But I say, yes, you talk, write like you talk, like you're talking to somebody. Then you go back and you do the editing. So, it was just stories that I had. I just was writing like crazy, just wrote and just remembering things. And that's why I had to keep going back and saying, I remember if I told this story and this story, but I think I pretty much covered everything.
Right. Well, yeah, they're real people, but they're like characters. So, you know, there's sort of the character development. I mean, you know, through your chapters about, you know, your brothers and your father and your mother, they really, they're real, but they come to life on the page, and you can sort of, I understand their pain and, you know, sort of understand what would lead them to cause you pain and to cause others pain, because they're so damaged themselves.
Exactly. Well, that's obvious for people. You know, they say that people that are abused are the abusers have been abused themselves. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a commonality. And I think that I feel sorry for a lot of the members of my family of origin. I think they're very lost souls, and I think they have a lot of issues, and I'm so glad that I've overcome that and am recovering from all of that dysfunction and illnesses that I didn't follow those ways that they went. I didn't abuse drugs. I didn't, you know, I didn't become an alcoholic. And, you know, I just was a very determined person to have the strength to carry on. And because there's so many things about life that's so great.
Mm. When you look back, can you see that this is something that's kind of been carried on through generations?
I think about that once in a while, Michaela. I think that it's very hard for me to see that because I think of my mother's parents, and we had a very close relationship, and they were, I didn't see that. So I'm really not certain about that.
Yeah. Talk about some of the parts of your book that are the good parts, you know, the funny stories, the hope part of all of this, because the book is extremely insightful, and anyone who has even a smidgen of a similar experience will be able to relate. But share with us some of the parts that are brighter and happier.
The joy.
The joyous is the meeting of my husband, Jack, and that was a great experience, and how he proposed to me on the Golden Gate Bridge, one of my favorite landmarks. And, of course, giving birth to my two sons, that was amazing, and the loves of my life, because they have brought me so much joy and wonder, and just their growing up years and how what they've accomplished, that brings me a lot of joy. I do have some funny stories and that I've done some public readings as well and shared some crazy stories about my life and about my trip through Europe and my meeting and starting the Joe Cocker fan club, international fan club. That's a great story. Everyone really likes to hear about that. and so there are a lot of really good positive things in the book too. It's not just depressing about the dysfunction and the sociopathology and all that. Because there is a lot of that, but I did want to write about positive things in my life because there are a lot of positive things in my life, because it's not just all about sadness, but the positive things and how it has brought me to where I am today, mm-hmm. and given me hope and hopefully to give others hope that there's so many things to live for.
Hmm. Other than writing, do you have other interests or hobbies?
Well, I love sports. I'm a huge, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'm a huge Laker fan. But I was born and raised in Los Angeles, so I'm allowed to be. And so I do love to watch basketball. And I like hiking and traveling and cooking. I'm a great cook, and sharing fun times with my critters, my dogs, and my cat. Mm-hmm.
And will you write another book? Will you think about?
Well, I'm hoping to do another. I'm hoping to write a play with my husband.
Oh.
And submitting that for the 10-minute play contest that we have with Redwood Writers, and I wrote some haikus for the poetry anthology that's mm-hmm. going to be coming out, and I'm hoping those get published as well. So nice. I just like to do a little bit of, writing here and there. I'd like to learn how to write fiction and turn reality into fiction. So that's what I'm working on.
You're a wonderful writer.
Thank you, Gary.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Sure. So tell our listeners how they can get the book.
Okay, well, you can order the book through Amazon, or it's also on Kindle, and it's available on CreateSpace as well.
Nice, nice. In any bookstores? Is it at Copperfield?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Not yet. And I'm working on getting it at the library as well. So.
Right, mm-hmm. right. Have you approached any other therapists or groups about using the book? And
my former therapist, who encouraged me to write the book in the first place, mm-hmm. Has purchased a copy, and she's letting her colleagues know about it. Mm. And there are a lot of people that are saying that this might be a really great reading for psychology classes and something like that mm-hmm. for in college mm-hmm. classes.
Right.
Because
right.
this is definitely
yes
for 17 and up.
right.
And go ahead.
I was say we just have a few minutes left, but talk a bit about Twinless Twins. I don't want to end on a downbeat, but I think okay. it's been a positive thing for you.
Yes. So. Well, I found Twinless Twins on the internet about a year and a half after I lost Steve. And it is an organization for those of us that lost our twins through death and estrangement. And it is an international organization support group. And I am the West Coast Regional Coordinator for this organization. Mm-hmm. So I have California, Oregon, Washington, Hawaii, and Alaska.
Goodness. Wow.
Mm-hmm. And I was just going to ask, if people wanted to personally get in touch with you, is there a way to do that?
I have a website. It's www.pamelafender.com. And if they need to reach me any other way, I guess they can call you, Gary.
Absolutely.
But
Most people know how to get a hold of me.
Pamela Fender, FENDER.com.
Yes.
Okay.
Great. Pamela, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
And also thank you for telling your story and sharing it with everyone, because I think there's really something there for folks who have suffered through similar experiences.
Yeah. I just want to share that there is light at the end of the tunnel.
Beautiful.
And
beautiful.
You are part of that light, you know.
Thank you, Michaela.
We wish you the very best. Please stay in touch.
Thanks, Gary.
All right.
I will.
We'll be right back with Rachel Gardner after we take a little musical break. This is Mika with the title track from his 2012 release, The Origin of Love.
Some love is a candy cane. It tastes so sweet, believes you feeling sick.
And welcome back to Outbeat Collage Out in the Arts. I'm Michaela Kennan, here in studio with my co-host Gary Carnevale, our engineer Mary Moore Campagna, and I'm most happy to welcome back Rachel Gardner. She is the acting deputy executive director and client services manager of Food for Thought, the Sonoma County AIDS Food Bank. Welcome back, Rachel. Good to have you again.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here, and I do my best to act like the deputy.
A deputy. Do you have a little badge? No gun. Maybe just a badge. Yeah. Calabash, a celebration of Gourd's Art and Garden, happens Sunday, October 6th at Food for Thought's gorgeous Forestville location. Rachel, tell us all about the event, which is in its 13th year.
Yes, we... this is the 13th time that we're doing this event, and it's grown to be the second largest fundraiser for the food bank, supporting our services for folks living with HIV in the county. And it is a really pretty spectacular event. It's a serious cause, but a very festive event. So a lot of people come year after year and really look forward to it. There's, in addition to the silent auction of really amazing gourd art done by artists from all over the county. Many of the pieces are done with gourds that we grow at the garden at the food bank, which is really special. There's also great food and wine, professional musicians playing instruments that are made out of gourds, tours of our amazing organic gardens, and it's just a really festive community event.
For those who don't really understand the scope of what goes into putting on something like this, give us a little insight to the processes, you know, how many rental tables you need and who you have to contact and what kind of licenses are necessary. And
yeah, it's pretty vast. We spend a lot of time working on the event. We use close to 100 volunteers for the event, and we're a volunteer-run agency, so we have a lot of volunteers that work with us, but this is a really... challenging one to get enough volunteers for, and they do pretty much everything that it takes to put the event together. We have a professional caterer working on the event this year, Lynn McCarthy from Cottonwood Catering. We get donations from probably about 20 different wineries. A lot of local grocery stores allow us to shop there to buy food for the event. The musicians, and then there are the artists. There's 85 artists this year that have made pieces for the event, and we probably will have a few over 100 works of gourd art this year to be auctioned.
That's great. And once again, though, it takes probably a year's planning to get everything in place. You've got, you know, the artists have to apply probably, and...
Yeah, there are a lot of pieces, and this is certainly one, is getting the word out to doing the PR is a big piece of it, getting the materials designed and mailed and trying to get as much press as we can for the event. After 12 years, it doesn't take quite as much planning because we pretty much know, you know, things start falling into place, and a lot of our volunteers and staff have now done it year after year. So it seems it's a little bit less taxing than it was when we first started to do it. But it is at the food bank. It's the only event that we do that takes place at the food bank, and that makes it its importance is more than just the money that it brings in, because for a lot of people, it's the first time that they've seen the site. When a lot of people think of a food bank, they don't have an image of what the place is, which is a beautiful facility with organic gardens all around it. It's a very welcoming place. It's a very beautiful place. And it sort of shifts people's idea of what we're doing by coming and actually seeing it and getting a tour of the building. And also, a lot of people come because they're interested in gourds, or they're interested in harvest events, they're interested in the garden, but they're not there necessarily because of the cause, and they get to hear us talk about the work that we do. Mm-hmm. And so we get some new donors and volunteers, which is great.
How many folks are you expecting?
I'm hoping close to 500.
500, wow.
Yeah. We put up big tents in the parking lot. The place is really transformed. So, yeah.
Yeah. The gardens are open and people are just wandering. Like you said, there's music and art. It's just, It's just fabulous. And the North Bay Bohemian voted Calabash the best fundraiser of the year.
Yeah, that was a great we were thinking, you know, every year we think when you do something like this year after year, are people still loving it? Is mm-hmm. it and we were not quite sure how much longer we would be doing it. And then that's a great vote of confidence. Yeah, that mm-hmm. the Bohemian readers voted it the best nonprofit event of the year.
And so a lot of competition. I mean, a lot of really important yes. nonprofits in Sonoma County, and a lot of money raised and a lot of need. And
exactly. So, yeah, that was a great vote of confidence. And we take a lot of pride in that. So, yeah,
I think it's probably for those who aren't really familiar with either Food Forethought or the Calabash event overall, it's important to say this is more than just a craft fair.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, granted, there are artisan crafts there, but you're talking music, music.
The music is fantastic. Doug Gosling, who used to do an African radio show on this station, mm-hmm. He gets the musicians, and they're fantastic. And there's a range of instruments that are made out of gourds. And, yeah, so that's a lot of the draw for mm-hmm. people coming.
And the food, is it available for purchase?
The people pay at the door or ahead to come in. And then once they're there, they get to hear the music. They see the art show, can bid on the artwork, and also can eat and drink. Mm-hmm. So, and it's the best of the county. The food is really fantastic.
Good, good. And this also marks the 25th anniversary for Food for Thought. So give us a sense of the history of the organization and how its response to the HIV/AIDS crisis has been so effective over the last 25.
Sure. So the food bank was started in 89 in the kind of early days of the epidemic in the county. Sonoma County was hit particularly hard in the early days of the AIDS epidemic. And there was a lot of activism. ACT UP was pretty active in the county. And just as a response to the need that there was in the face of a lot of neglect by the government and the church and organizations that usually help people in need, because it was gay men who were hit by the AIDS epidemic in the early days. That's not a population that the culture at large cared particularly about. And so there was a lot of neglect. And so a lot of agencies, ours face-to-face, even the county first got involved, it was all in providing health care. It was all because of activism, people who were living with HIV, or people who knew people who were living with HIV realized we better take care of one another. And so Food for Thought was started by a group of people basically sitting around a kitchen table and deciding we need to do something. We need to feed people because they're starving to death in their homes and nobody's taking care of them. And so over the years, over the 25 years, Food for Thought has grown tremendously. We serve over 675 men, women, and children now who are affected by HIV and AIDS. It's still very much a grassroots, community-based agency. We're almost all volunteer-run. We have about as many volunteers as we have clients who work there. And I think what makes the agency really unique is that it still feels like, and it still is, the community taking care of itself. A lot of our volunteers are also clients at the food bank. There have always been people on staff who are HIV positive. There's never been a sense of us and them. It's always felt like it's a place that people feel respected and safe and not stigmatized because of having HIV. Mm-hmm. And as the population diversified, and now so many of the people, we have clients who've been living with HIV for 30 or more years who are all aging, and so we've had to really shift. We're serving really healthy food now. The food people who founded the food bank always were interested in healthy food. But now we're looking at keeping people healthy and for decades, not mm-hmm. just for the 6 months, mm-hmm. which was mm-hmm. what people were expected to live when they were diagnosed years ago.
And speaking of volunteers, you voted Ron Higgins Volunteer of the Year. Tell us a bit about Ron and what makes for a great volunteer.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot that makes for a great volunteer. Ron is a really special man. He has been a volunteer for about 5 years. He retired about a year ago and has just really devoted himself to the food bank. And what made him, I think, really a candidate for Volunteer of the Year is just the range of things that he does for us. He does a weekly shift, sometimes more than that, waiting on clients in the food bank. He works in the office answering phones, doing data entry, doing other office kind of work. He works pretty much every special event that we do. And he's just one of those people who says yes whenever you need him. If he's able to do it, he says yes. And that makes what we do possible. So he's very, very involved in Calabash. He has a background in, he used to work at Quicksilver Mine Company. So he has a background in working in galleries, so he can handle artwork. And he's really a key player at Calabash.
Yay for Ron.
Yay for Ron.
So I'm thinking now it's been almost a year since the big dining out for life came about. And this is a national event, but Food for Thought benefits greatly from this as well. Just give us a whole sense of what that involves.
About Dining Out for Life? Yeah, Dining Out for Life is actually our biggest event, our biggest fundraiser. It's a really important event for us, and it is something that's done all over the country. Here in Sonoma County, it benefits Food for Thought, and this year it is on Thursday night, December 5th, and over 85 restaurants all over the county donate either 25 or 50% of everybody's food tab to the food bank. So the restaurants themselves make huge donations. Some of them donate the proceeds from the wine sales as well. We count on a lot of people going out to eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner that day, and we make a lot of money on that event, and it's a really important one for us. So there's a wide range of restaurants, really fancy ones, more casual ones, pretty much every kind of cuisine available in the county. And it's a great night to go out.
In close just enough, about every city in the county.
Yes, yes. And it's close enough to the holidays for people to maybe have their business lunches and holiday lunches and things like that around that time. So last year was a huge rainstorm. I think it was torrential. We managed to have a good night anyway. We're hoping for good weather this year and for a really big night. We're, you know, continuing every year to serve more and more clients. Food and gas prices go up. So we need more and more money every year. And like most nonprofits, spend a lot of our time raising money. And so that's an easy one for people to participate in because everybody loves to go out and eat.
And 7 years ago, Food for Thought became the owners of a 3,200-square-foot antique store in Sebastopol.
Yes.
That is now called Food for Thought Antiques.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about this great shop and why folks should start their holiday shopping there.
Well, the store just has a great collection of eclectic, really wonderful items. The people who run the store do a great job of purchasing. We have a lot of support from the people living in the county who donate things to us, collectibles, antiques, all kinds of interesting things. And we're also doing estate sales now. So we're getting a lot of really amazing merchandise, and it's a great place to shop, and all of the proceeds go to the food bank. So
the book collection is amazing. I mean, if you're looking for sort of out of print LGBT books or just collectible books, it's just a great spot for that. I'm really amazed at the collection. I've just been there a few times and said, wow, this book is really worth a lot of money, I think.
And yeah, the books are great. There's great furniture and collectibles. Mm-hmm. So a lot of old rusty stuff for the garden.
Right.
Stuff for the house.
Right.
Yeah. So and the merchandise keeps shifting. So every time you go in, there are new things to see and desire.
And are those donated or?
Yes.
So if you have some rusty stuff in your garden that you think would be worthy of Food for Thought antiques.
Or any really valuable antiques, right. We'd love those donated as well.
Good. And talk just a little bit about the idea of growing some of your own food, starting gardens, and getting into the whole cooking and nutrition part.
Yeah, well, the goal of the food bank is to improve people's nutrition. And we don't make any judgments about the way that people eat. We just want to help people eat better, and help people eat well. For some people, that means just having food. And for some people, it means getting healthier foods or freeing up them financially a little bit by what they can get so that they can actually purchase healthier foods as well. We also give out vitamins and nutritional supplements. We have a nutritionist on, she actually works for West County Health Centers, but she's with us one day a week. She does cooking classes, nutrition classes for clients, and one-on-one consultations. So we do really comprehensive nutrition services there.
Good. And talk with us just a little bit about your involvement with the Get Tested HIV Anti-Stigma campaign.
Yeah, this is something that's really, really dear to my heart. And I would love to sometime come on and just talk to you about HIV stigma, because
absolutely,
I think it's a really important topic. We're doing this in collaboration with West County Health Centers. It's for 1 week. The week of November 3rd through 9th this year, we're asking people to wear T-shirts that say, does this T-shirt make me look HIV positive? Mm. The back of the T-shirt says, not positive, get tested. And the reason that we're doing it is, actually, there are two reasons. One is that we just, from doing the work with people day in and day out who are HIV positive, we see the negative impact that stigma has on people. It keeps people from getting in care. It keeps people from feeling like worthy human beings when they internalize the stigma. And it also, in addition to the impact it has on people who are already living with HIV, it keeps people from getting tested because they are afraid to ask for a test. There's just a whole range of reasons that stigma keeps people from getting tested, and it keeps also doctors from asking people to test. So it's considered the biggest barrier to ending the epidemic at this point all over the world. And there are, we think that there are, of the 2,000 or more people who are living with HIV in Sonoma County, there are probably around 500 who have HIV and don't know it. And we want to find those people and have them get tested, and so that they can get healthy themselves and not spread the virus any further.
Sounds like a great, great idea.
Yes.
And this started at Food for Thought, or is this a national movement?
This is these kinds of campaigns have been done all over. Mm-hmm. We decided to do it, start in the West County. We'll probably like to expand it throughout Sonoma County, if it goes well. It's a big project that we're doing kind of on top of everything else, but it feels really, really important. And so at this point, we're looking for people to get the T-shirts, to be willing to wear them, to upload a photo of themselves on our Facebook page. We have a website. Can I say that really quick?
Yes, we want to get that out, sure.
www.gettestedsonoma.org. You could also visit the Food for Thought website, which is www.fftfoodbank.org. You could buy calabash tickets there. You could find out more about the anti-stigma campaign, make donations, find out about volunteering, or if you are interested in signing up for services, you can get more information there as well.
Great. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for all the good work you do.
Yes. And we'll see you at Calabash on Sunday, October 6th.
1 to 5 p.m.
Great. We also want to thank author Pamela Fender for joining us tonight. We want to thank you for listening to Outbeat Collage tonight. And we hope you'll tune in every Sunday night for the full schedule of Outbeat Radio programming. Next week, Greg Moraliev will be back here hosting Outbeat News in Depth. Greg and I will be together hosting Outbeat Radio 5th Sunday on September 29th. Our guest will be openly gay city councilman Gabe Kearney, Petaluma councilman, and the producers of the LGBTQI Days of Films. Mikhail, Mary, and I will return next month, Sunday, October 20th, when our guests will be local author Joe Lauer and Rick Dean from Face to Face. Listen to all previous Outbeat Radio shows at www.outbeatradio.com. Enjoy what remains of your weekend and good night.
We'll see you next time.